Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we are reading from the May 27th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is on a bright red background. It shows a man's arm holding an assault rifle in the air. The arm has a short sleeve camouflage shirt. And on the forearm is a tattoo in red, or the numbers 1488. And in the middle is a circular swastika. The headline is White Nativist Terrorism. Replacement theory fuels yet another mass shooting. The drawing is even more ominous in light of the news from yesterday that there was another mass shooting at an elementary school in Texas. I'm sure we'll read about that soon. First main story. A white supremacist massacre in Buffalo. What happened? An 18-year-old gunman, fueled by his belief in replacement theory, shot and killed 10 black people at a supermarket in Buffalo last week, casting a spotlight on the spread of a once-fringe racist ideology. Peyton Gendron, a college dropout from upstate New York, opened fire with a Bushmaster XM-15 assault weapon in a market on Buffalo's predominantly black east side after planning for months a bloodbath designed to kill as many blacks as possible. He laid out his motives in a manifesto that echoed online screeds claiming that a cabal of leftist elites and globalist Jews are conspiring to gain power by replacing white, native-born Christians with dark-skinned foreigners. Blacks and immigrants invade our lands and attack and replace our people, wrote Gendron, who said he'd been radicalized by reading online message boards. He expressed admiration for other racist mass murderers, including the white supremacists who in 2019 gunned down 51 people at mosques in New Zealand and another who killed 23 people in El Paso, Texas in 2019 to repel what he called a Hispanic invasion. Gendron, who live-streamed the shooting, surrendered to police and was charged with murder. President Biden traveled to Buffalo and spoke out against the spread of replacement theory, which has been promoted by some Republican lawmakers and conservative media figures, including Fox News host Tucker Carlson. A recent AP poll showed that 1 in 3 U.S. adults and 42% of Republicans believe there's an effort to replace U.S.-born Americans with immigrants for electoral gains. Biden warned that white supremacy is a poison that's been allowed to fester and grow right in front of our eyes. What the editorial said. The Buffalo Massacre represents a conflagration of two of America's most noxious poisons, said the New York Daily News. Deadly firearms and metastasizing white supremacist hate. Gendron was able to legally purchase his weapon of war, despite having been investigated for a shooting threat at his high school last year. And his mind was poisoned by an abhorrent ideology from the neo-Nazi fringes that has infected mainstream politicians and Fox News pundits. Feeding white anxiety might be a cynical game to them, but words have consequences. Democrats' transparently political effort to blame this tragedy on Republicans is despicable, said the Wall Street Journal. They cast as racist anyone opposed to open borders or critical race theory or the Democratic Party's hyper-race consciousness. And now they've gone a step further and suggested Republicans are accomplices in racially motivated domestic terrorism. Exploiting this tragedy is apparently the best strategy Democrats have to hang on to power in an election year. What the columnist said, replacement theory is becoming central to the modern GOP's worldview, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Fox's Carlson has promoted replacement theory on his top-rated show more than 400 times. Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, the third-ranking House Republican, has run ads saying Democrats want to grant amnesty to illegal immigrants to overthrow the current electorate. Blame Gendron for his horrific actions, but also blame the prominent right-wing voices that egged him on. Only one person is to blame for the Buffalo massacre. Gendron himself, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. In an open society with free speech, a small minority are apt to turn any particular species of angry nonsense into violence. In his manifesto, Gendron never mentions Carlson, expresses his hatred for Fox, and calls modern conservatism corporatism in disguise. Gendron was no lone wolf, said Talia Levine in Rolling Stone. He was just another disaffected young man, radicalized by a steady diet of white racial panic. As the country's demographics change, white conservatives are increasingly gripped by the apocalyptic fear that they will become a minority in America, a major impetus for the election of Donald Trump. With Fox and Trumpist Republicans spewing out annihilatory rhetoric, there will be more tragedies, and the corpses will continue to accrue. The controversy of the week is baby formula, how a nationwide shortage was born. Is my baby getting enough food? It's a fear that every new parent has, said David Leonard in the New York Times, but one that's become acute for millions of Americans caught up in a nationwide shortage of baby formula. Stores have about 43% less stock of formula than usual, creating an urgent problem. Some infants cannot drink breast milk, and a lot of working mothers simply don't have the time or place to breastfeed. Major store chains like CVS and Walmart are rationing how much formula a person can buy, and desperate moms and dads are scouring shops and the internet for formula supplies, often vastly overpaying for any they do find. It gets really scary, says Carrie Fleming, a mother in Pell City, Alabama. She spent $245 on three small cans of formula she found online, and she's putting half a scoop less into each bottle to make it last longer. It's astonishing that the wealthiest, most advanced, and most prosperous nation on the planet is struggling to feed its babies, said Jim Garrity in National Review. The main reason for the shortage is that one of the big formula producers, Abbott Laboratories, shut down a manufacturing plant in Michigan in February because of a potential bacteria outbreak that may have sickened four babies. The Food and Drug Administration finally announced this week that the facility could resume operations, but Abbott says it'll take a couple of months before its products are back on the shelves. Even before Abbott's shutdown, COVID-related problems in the global supply chain had strained formula supplies, some of which come from overseas. The pandemic caused staffing and ingredient shortages for formula producers, and hoarding caused seesawing demand. All these problems have been made worse by monopoly, said David Dayen in Prospect.org. Half of all formula sales go through a federal program called Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, which provides vouchers to low-income families. Abbott and other big producers offer massive discounts to become the chosen suppliers, which has resulted in massive market concentration. As of 2018, Abbott and three other companies control about 89% of the U.S. market. The most important part of the story is America's protectionist policy, said Derek Thompson in The Atlantic. Most of the formula made in the European Union is illegal to buy here, even though it's just as nutritious, if not better, than our stuff. Foreign-made formula that does meet FDA requirements is slapped with big tariffs. The new North America trade agreement forged by President Trump actually actively discourages formula imports from our largest trading partner, Canada. So much for the faddish drive to produce everything in America, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Global trade has its uses, including increasing competition and supply. There are some obvious fixes, said Scott Lincecum in thedispatch.com. The federal government should immediately eliminate barriers to imported infant formula so that Americans can always buy it from other well-regulated countries. If it's good enough for Europe, Canada, Australia, and the like, it's good enough for us. And WIC vouchers should be valid for all formula brands, not just the chosen few. These changes won't put formula on American store shelves tomorrow, but they may at least help prevent this nightmare from happening again. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for European unity after Ukrainian band Kalush Orchestra won the Eurovision Song Contest, defeating 24 other European performers with the largest number of fan votes in the contest's 66-year history. The winning song includes the line, "I'll always find my way home, even if all roads are destroyed." It was a good week for pay equity after the U.S. soccer women's and men's national teams agreed to new contracts that will pay male and female players equally, with the women's team getting a 54% increase. And it was a good week for Senator Ted Cruz after the Supreme Court's six conservative justices sided with the Texas Republican, ruling his free speech rights were violated by a federal ban on influence-seeking donors repaying a candidate's campaign loan to himself. But it was a bad week for border walls after border officials discovered yet another secret 600-yard tunnel from Tijuana to San Diego, equipped with rail and ventilation systems, electricity, and reinforced walls. It was a bad week for corporate bullying after the publisher of the British version of the magazine Vogue warned a 150-year-old pub, the Star Inn at Vogue, to change its name. Pub owner Mark Graham replied with a categorical no and asked the magazine why it didn't seek permission from the villagers of the real Vogue. And finally, it was a bad week for price gouging after a coffee bar in Florence was fined 1,000 euros for charging 2 euros for a cup of espresso. Alessandro Sorani, the head of a local business association, said a fine espresso is hard work and that the fine is something that deeply embitters me. The title of the briefing is The Doctrine of Stare Decisis. The Supreme Court follows a tradition of honoring precedent. most of the time. What is stare decisis? It's a centuries-old legal principle stating that judges should defer to past interpretations of statutes and the Constitution. It comes from the Latin expression stare decisis et non quieta movere, meaning to stand by things decided and not disturb the calm. Erring on the side of upholding precedent makes the law seem even-handed and predictable. Then Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote in 1984. Justice Louis Brandeis had gone further in 1932, writing, "In most matters, it is more important that the applicable rule of law be settled than it be settled right." But periodically throughout U.S. history, about 232 times to be precise, justices have disregarded stare decisis and overruled their predecessors. A 5-4 conservative majority appears poised to do that with Roe v. Wade. And Justice Samuel Alito devotes a substantial chunk of his leaked draft opinion to arguing why Roe was egregiously wrong from the start and thus unworthy of stare decisis. When can precedent be overruled? Whenever a majority of Supreme Court justices feel like it. Some legal scholars argue that a select group of old landmark cases should be considered irreversible super precedent, but the court has observed repeatedly that stare decisis is not an inexorable command. In a 2020 opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh mapped a 7-prong test for applying stare decisis. The quality of the precedent's reasoning, the precedent's consistency with other decisions, changes in law since, changes in fact since, the decision's workability, the degree to which people have come to rely on it, and the precedent's age. Nearly everyone agrees, at least in theory, that it's not sufficient for new justices to personally disagree with earlier rulings on ideological grounds. In 2018, when 5 conservatives ruled that the First Amendment protects public sector employees from being forced to pay union dues if they're not members, Justice Elena Kagan accused the majority of overturning a 1977 precedent for no exceptional or special reason, but because it never liked the decision. What's been overturned? Some of the Supreme Court's most momentous decisions rejected precedent. Perhaps most famously, in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education ended racial segregation in public schools, overturning the separate but equal doctrine established in the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson ruling. In 1976, the court ruled that Georgia's administration of the death penalty didn't violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment, invalidating a decision from just 5 years earlier. More recently, the court in 2003 deemed laws banning sodomy and gay sex to be unconstitutional, reversing a 1986 decision, and in 2015 identified a right to same-sex marriage, overturning a one-sentence ruling from 1972. The 2010 decision in Citizens United v. FEC, striking down limits on corporate campaign spending, overturned 2 decisions, one as recent as 2003. When the court upheld President Trump's travel ban in 2018, Chief Justice John Roberts went out of his way to disown the infamous 1944 decision in Korematsu v. United States, which let stand the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Korematsu was gravely wrong, Roberts wrote, and has no place in law under the Constitution. Is there an ideological pattern? Legal scholars like to joke that stare decisis is Latin for stand by things decided when it suits our purposes. Every justice claims to respect stare decisis, but both liberals and conservatives have attacked their rivals for abandoning precedent when ideologically convenient. The ultra-liberal Warren Court overturned up to four precedents per term. Roberts frequently expounds on the importance of stare decisis, but since 2005, he has voted with the majority about three-quarters of the time on rulings that overturned precedent. Conservative Justice Clarence Thomas is leading the charge to discount stare decisis, saying the court should not be bound by demonstrably incorrect previous rulings. "We use stare decisis as a mantra when we don't want to think," he said. "Are more precedents in jeopardy?" Liberal court watchers say Alito's leaked opinion is a blueprint for gutting other privacy-related rights. In his draft, Alito says Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 case affirming the central holding of Roe, must be overturned because there is no right to privacy or abortion in the Constitution, and that implicit rights must be deeply rooted in this nation's history. But previous courts cited a right to privacy as the constitutional basis for protecting access to contraception, legalizing gay sex and same-sex marriage, and other rights that are now in the conservative movement's crosshairs. Alito insists that overturning Roe does not threaten precedents that do not concern abortion, but his assurance is hardly binding. 2 years ago, he and Thomas complained in an opinion that the court had created a novel constitutional right in same-sex marriage that was ruinous to religious liberty. The court, they said, has created a problem that only it can fix. Misleading the Senate. Trump's high court nominees, Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett, reportedly all plan to join Alito and Thomas in overturning Roe. The news drew outrage from senators such as Republican Susan Collins of Maine, who said their vote would be completely inconsistent with what Gorsuch and Kavanaugh in particular said during their confirmation hearings. Conservatives, however, say the future justices chose their words carefully. Gorsuch told the Senate that Roe has been reaffirmed, adding, "A good judge will treat it like any other precedent." "I accept the law of the land," he testified. Kavanaugh called the case important precedent of the Supreme Court that has been reaffirmed many times. Barrett, whose personal opposition as a Catholic to abortion drew intense scrutiny during her confirmation, declined to call the right to an abortion a super precedent, saying, "I'm answering a lot of questions about Roe, which I think indicates that Roe doesn't fall into that category." After Alito's draft leaked, Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, said, "Justices looking at you in the face and telling you one thing and then doing something different, that's very troubling." We'll move into some of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with "Abortion Seen in Shades of Gray." "If Roe v. Wade is overturned and abortion laws are going to be debated in the state," said Peter Winner, "both sides should acknowledge the inescapable ambiguities of this staggeringly complicated moral question. As a Christian who believes Roe was wrongly decided, I see some inconsistencies in the absolutism of the pro-life side. If a fertilized egg is a full human being at the moment of conception, what is the meaning of the fact that about half of all fertilized eggs are aborted spontaneously? Are the deaths of those eggs comparable to when a 2-year-old child dies? If not, why not?" Pro-choicers, on the other hand, are so adamant that abortion decisions belong solely to the woman and her doctor that they object to any gestational or other legal limits. Most Americans view an embryo or fetus as developing along a continuum, with unborn life becoming a human child sometime before birth. But adamant pro-choicers are unwilling to concede that abortions become more ethically problematic the further along in a pregnancy. Let's face it, with life in the womb, we're dealing with an awesome mystery, and wise policy decisions will require caution, humility, and a touch of grace and empathy. Pigeonholing actors by identity. Let actors act, said Pamela Paul. That should be a given. But now that Hollywood and Broadway have wisely moved on from stereotypical portrayals of black, Asian, gay, and other marginalized groups, they risk ricocheting to the other undesirable extreme, limiting actors to roles that correspond with their real-life identities. Earlier this year, Helen Mirren was accused of engaging in Jewface by portraying late Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir in an upcoming film. Even Tom Hanks' Oscar-winning portrayal of a gay AIDS patient in 1993's Philadelphia no longer plays so well in some quarters. Some progressives now insist that actors can't possibly do justice to a role they haven't lived. But by definition, good actors are artists who are able to find a way to portray people who are not like themselves. The new identity standard would have robbed us of countless great performances, such as Hanks in Philadelphia and Daniel Day-Lewis' extraordinary portrayal of a disabled artist in 1989's My Left Foot. Actor Ian McKellen, who happens to be gay, asks, "Does that mean I can't play straight parts?" "Absurd," he says. "We're acting. We're pretending." This column comes from Russia. Chechens know how evil Russia can be. The world may be shocked by Russia's atrocities in Ukraine, but I'm not, says Angkor Mashkadov. We Chechens are acutely aware that everything that is happening now has already happened before. Russian troops slaughtered 300,000 Chechen civilians during two brutal wars in the renegade Russian province and then settled in for 30 years of what many Chechens call totalitarian occupation. Chechnya tried to declare independence on multiple occasions after the 1991 breakup of the Soviet Union. When Russia first invaded in 1994, we naively assumed the world would stand behind us and it would all stop. Instead, we were left to face Russia's barbarism alone. After Russian troops failed to defeat us in battle, despite their overwhelming advantages, they began to take out their anger on the civilian population, burning homes with flamethrowers as people helplessly hid inside. During the Second War, which began in 1999, the brutality only grew. Russians dismembered civilians, raped and murdered women, and set up dystopian filtration camps where they tortured many, including children, just as they have now done in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Russian evil will not stop unless we stop it altogether. And it's time for our feature article, The Last Word. Smoke-flavored Cabernet. Much of Napa Valley's 2020 vintage was ruined by raging wildfires, said Benjamin Wallace in New York Magazine. Climate change threatens the future of Napa's wine industry. Anita Oberholster wouldn't say what we were drinking. We were standing in the teaching and research winery at the University of California, Davis, the country's preeminent incubator of future grape growers and vintners, and on the table in front of us were three identical wine bottles with red screw caps. Instead of a label, each bore a white strip that read, "Sample for Research," along with a cryptic string of letters and numbers. The bottles, which came from vineyards in the Napa Valley, contained Cabernet Sauvignon from the 2020 vintage. They had all been made from grapes harvested after the glass fire, a blaze that tore through Napa, burning almost 68,000 acres and turning the skies orange. When trees burn, lignin, a chemical compound that gives wood much of its structure, releases into the smoke a range of volatile phenols, a class of airborne molecules. Grapes aren't the only crop that can be affected by smoke, but their permeable skins and the very sensitivity that allows vintners to produce expressive, complex wines makes them uniquely vulnerable. Oberholster, an exacting South African-born chemist at UC Davis Department of Viticulture and Enology, is the closest thing California has to an expert on smoke and wine. And after the fire died down, wineries began sending her clusters of grapes and samples of wine in the desperate hope that she could help them prepare for the next disaster. Oberholster poured samples of the three wines, and we both picked up the leftmost glass and stuck our noses in. I didn't smell anything smoky. "They're a bit cold, unfortunately," she said. Cold means less volatile, which means less aromatic. These grapes were picked from a hillside where the glass fire had come right up to the vineyard, but the smoke hadn't lingered. "There is smoke there," Oberholster continued, "but you need to look for it." I spat the wine into a blue pail and took another sip. A stale, ashy flavor began to emerge. Would she consider this an extremely tainted wine? "It goes through phases," she said. "Currently, it's medium." Lifting the second glass to my nose, I thought I detected bacon. I took a sip. The flavor seemed stunted, as if it were about to reveal itself, but then decided it would rather not. I sniffed again. Now the wine smelled like a spent day-old cigarette. "This wine's grapes came from the Napa Valley floor," Oberholster said, "where the smoke from the glass fire had lingered for days." The third Cabernet smelled better than the others. When the wine first touched my tongue, it tasted something like the vicinity of berry juice. "Because there's a lot there to mask," Oberholster said, meaning the wine's other qualities, its fruits and tannins and acid, were strong enough to compete with any smoke compounds, at least initially. Sure enough, the longer the wine was in my mouth, the more sooty and dead it tasted, and the more I wanted to spit it out. Major wildfires first seriously threatened the California wine region, Mendocino County, in 2008. But not until 2017 did they pose a significant danger to the state's most hallowed vines. That October, a string of fires, including the Tubbs Fire, the most destructive in state history up to that point, burned more than 110,700 acres in Napa and Sonoma counties. People wanted to say, "Oh, smoke taint doesn't exist." Elisa Jacobson, a winemaker who would later help form the West Coast Smoke Exposure Task Force, told me they didn't want the media or anyone to think they were going to get smoke in their wines. The 2020 fires were a turning point for Napa's grape growers and winemakers. The first of them hit earlier in the season than the 2017 fires had, and many grapes were vulnerable because they hadn't yet been harvested. And when the glass fire arrived in late September, it devastated the later ripening varieties still on the vine, in particular Cabernet Sauvignon, the grape with which Napa is almost synonymous and the basis for California's preeminent luxury export. As we got ready to leave the tasting room, Oberholster gave me one of the bottles of Cabernet Sauvignon to take back to my hotel so I could try the wine after it warmed up. "Pour yourself a glass," she said, "and see if you can get through it before it starts getting extremely off-putting." Deer Park was just leveled, Alan Vieiter recalled. It was a morning in mid-February, and we were on the crest of the hill overlooking the main vineyard at Vieiter Winery, a 4,000-case direct-to-consumer producer founded by Vieiter's mother, Delia, in Napa in the late 1980s. Vieiter was talking about the glass fire, which had started before dawn on September 27, 2020. The fire originated near the winery and quickly made its way around the reservoir at its foot, then started burning up the hill, accelerated by dry grass on the vineyard floor and pushed along by the wind. Vieiter was at his home 15 miles south of the winery, and when he was finally able to get to the property the following night, fallen trees on the ground were still burning. The glass fire was not fully extinguished for 23 days. Afterward, Vieiter and his crew went vine by vine, cutting into each one to check its health and make sure the sap was flowing. Most of the Cabernet Franc vines survived because they were further from the flames, but the vines of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes, which anchor the Vieiter's wine, were decimated. Vieiter is still going back and forth with his insurance company over how much of his losses it will cover. Until 2020, vineyards themselves, being lush and irrigated and manicured, were considered firebreaks not requiring extensive coverage. Like a lot of other winemakers in his situation, Vieiter didn't get his policy renewed. The best he can hope for is a much smaller umbrella courtesy of the state's Fair Plan program, which he says won't insure more than $3 million. After the glass fire, Vieiter began preparing for the next time. We passed a pile of what looked like industrial-strength super soakers. They were water axes, gas-powered high-pressure pumps with fire hose nozzles that can shoot a blast of flame-dousing water 100 feet. In January, Vieiter enrolled in the local firefighting academy to become a volunteer, and today he wore a fire dispatch scanner on his belt. However diligent Vieiter's preparations for flames, there's much less he can do to guard against smoke, which can come from anywhere, including the properties of less fire-savvy winemakers. When fires swept through Northern California in 2020, casting shifting palls of smoke for more than 2 months, other winemakers were forced to make agonizing decisions about whether to even bother producing their wines. Napa has the most expensive farmland in the U.S., and the surest way to profit is to make pricey bottles of Cabernet. Once you're selling a luxury product, though, even minor imperfections can be fatal. "Maybe at $20 you're okay with a little smoke impact," said Jacobson, who at the time was a winemaker at Joel Gott Wines. "But at the $200 price point, you're not okay with any." California wine is a $40 billion plus industry, but only in the past few years has anybody paid much attention to the threat of smoke. To the extent that smoke taint has received scholarly scrutiny, the papers all came from the University of Adelaide in Australia, where Oberholster, the daughter of a wheat and canola farmer, happened to have obtained her graduate degree. Australia had been dealing with smoke taint since 2003, but there was a lot the Australians didn't know, and not everything they did know applied to California. From her colleagues in Australia, Oberholster learned that it isn't enough to test grapes for the volatile compounds detectable right away. One also has to test for the compounds that reveal themselves only months later, when fermentation unbinds the phenol sugar compounds and releases the volatile phenols and their smoky flavors. She had to inform devastated grape growers that there are no easy or one-size-fits-all fixes. Unless growers know exactly where the smoke in their vineyards came from, how long it was there, and exactly when it was created, its impact on the grapes will be unpredictable. One could have a vineyard next to a fire, but grapes 20 miles away could be more affected because of wind direction or topography. The best thing a grower could do, Oberholster said, was something that had been tried in Australia. Ferment a small batch of wine in a bucket and have a panel of tasters assess it. Ideally, five or more, as a certain percentage of tasters either don't taste smoke taint or are overly sensitive to it. People used to alchemizing $1,500 cabs in state-of-the-art steel vats, in other words, might have to resort to making wine in a plastic pail. As if smoke and fire weren't bad enough, the prized Napa cab, as we know it, is facing an even greater existential threat. As temperature extremes have become more common in recent years, the world's wine maps have begun to shift. We now have Chinese cab blends, Norwegian Rieslings, and critic-pleasing English sparkling wines. In regions where quality has historically fluctuated with vintage, depending on that year's weather, have been consistently producing good wine year after year. Some of that's better winemaking equipment and techniques, Massican Wines' Dan Petroski said, but a big part of it is weather. After the 2017 fire in Napa raised questions about whether climate change was to blame, Petroski, who had been the winemaker at Larkmead Vineyard since 2012, winning accolades including the San Francisco Chronicle's Winemaker of the Year, took it upon himself to go into the winery's records and track the dates of the growing season for the previous 10 years. Without anyone noticing, it seemed, the season had shifted 1 month forward over that period, the vines hitting peak ripeness earlier and earlier each year. Petroski saw several causes. For instance, since a big replanting in 2007, Larkmead had been growing healthier vines. But climate was undeniably a factor too, and Petroski began to believe Cabernet Sauvignon's days in Napa might be numbered. With the owner's blessing, Petroski decided to plant research vines on the property, using great wines from warmer climates as his guide. If someone comes in here and says, "Why are you planting Tempranillo?" I'd say, "Sorry, bro, don't you know about Vega Sicilia? It's $800 a bottle, and it's Tempranillo and Cabernet." And if they ask, "Why are you planting Touriga Nacional?" I'd say, "You're not familiar with Barca Vela? It's only been made 19 times in the past 100 years, and it's $500 a bottle. It's one of the greatest wines in the world." When he started talking about Cabernet losing its throne, Petroski said, "My nickname became Doomsday Dan." Today, lots of Napa wineries are undertaking similar experiments. Viotto told me that after the glass fire, he started shifting his wines toward the fresher, more acidic, lower alcohol style his mother had made when she was first starting out. These wines can be made from grapes picked earlier, shortening their exposure to fire risk. And though he was less pessimistic about the future of Cabernet, Viotto was setting aside 10% of the vineyard to experiment with varieties like Malbec, Grenache, Tempranillo, and Touriga Nacional. Some winemakers think their best option is leaving Napa entirely. Last year, after nearly two decades working in Napa, Jacobson, the former Gott winemaker, moved 360 miles south and bought two vineyards in the Santa Ynez Valley. "Santa Barbara has been relatively smoke-free for the last 10 years," she said. "That wasn't an accident. There's more water in the ground in Santa Barbara, so even without rain, the vines have more to drink, land is cheaper, and Santa Ynez doesn't have as many big forests, which, if they catch fire, create the blankets of dense smoke that spell doom for nearby grapes. In 2020, when Jacobson still worked at GOTT, she had to evacuate her home during one of the fires. "There's been an evacuation every year since 2017, she told me. "We keep saying, it's a wild year. But now they say that every year. It's getting pretty old." A version of this story was originally published in New York Magazine. On the health and science page now, ibuprofen can harm kidneys. Hypertension patients take note. Using ibuprofen in combination with drugs that are commonly prescribed to treat high blood pressure could lead to permanent kidney damage, a new study suggests. Researchers at the University of Waterloo used computer-simulated drug trials to examine the potential effects of combining the over-the-counter painkillers with diuretics and renin-angiotensin system inhibitors, also known as RSA inhibitors, both of which are used to treat hypertension. They found that the three-medication therapy, which doctors often prescribe as a triple whammy, appear to present a 31% higher risk for acute kidney injury compared with simulated patients given diuretics and RSA inhibitors alone. The mock trial suggests that certain individuals could be particularly susceptible, including those with an impaired myogenic response, the mechanism that regulates the diameter of blood vessels, and those with an increased sensitivity to drugs or a low water intake. It's not that everyone who happens to take this combination of drugs is going to have the problems, lead author Anita Layton tells ScienceDaily.com, but the research shows it's enough of a problem that you should exercise caution. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page, starting with January 6. What does McCarthy know? The full extent of the Republican cover-up of Donald Trump's role in the January 6 insurrection is being exposed, said Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. The House January 6 committee last week took the dramatic step of issuing subpoenas to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and four other Republicans who apparently communicated with the former president before, during, and after the riot that day, after they refused to voluntarily testify about what was said. Those GOP members will defy the subpoenas, setting up a legal battle, since the party's position is that the entire investigation is illegitimate. But the committee already knows that McCarthy in particular pleaded with Trump to call off the rioters as they stormed into the Capitol, and the details of that conversation may shed light on Trump's true insurrectionist intentions. No good will come of this effort, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The committee has already spent 10 months interviewing more than 1,000 witnesses and obtained tens of thousands of phone records, text messages, and documents. The subpoenas aren't likely to yield new information, even as they further erode whatever comity remains in the House. Democrats just want to embarrass Republicans and suggest they have some complicity with the riot. The Democrats may come to regret setting a precedent here, said Lisa Mascaro in the Associated Press. If Republicans take the House in November, they are likely to subpoena Democratic legislators in their own tit-for-tat investigations of Hunter Biden and other matters. Given what's at stake, Democrats are right to turn up the heat, said Hayes Brown in MSNBC.com. January 6 was an attempted coup. with the complicity of a sitting president and possibly members of Congress. A livid McCarthy initially blamed Trump for the insurrection, but because of the GOP is a MAGA party, reversed course in hopes of becoming Speaker of the House next year. Testifying about the day's events must be his worst nightmare. McCarthy, nonetheless, has an obligation to reveal what he knows, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The minority leader and his fellow Republicans were key witnesses to a direct assault on U.S. democracy. With the country vulnerable to another attack in 2024, their silence is shameful. COVID, ominous new trends. Our post-Omicron reprieve seems to be over, said Andrew Joseph in Stat. As the virus keeps evolving, subvariants such as BA2.12.1 are proving to be even more infectious than the original Omicron strain and are racing through the U.S. population. Known new cases are exceeding 90,000 a day. More worryingly, hospitalizations have started to increase and are up more than 20% in 2 weeks. Recent studies in South Africa and elsewhere suggest that infection by Omicron does not provide much cross-protection from other variants, and it's becoming likely even vaccinated people will get COVID 2 or 3 times a year. Alas, most of America simply no longer cares, said Daniel Dresner in the Washington Post. Those polled by the Pew Research Center last week ranked COVID dead last among 12 issues affecting the country. Those results bode ill for the Biden administration's request for $10 billion in additional COVID aid, which congressional Republicans have thus far blocked. If funding for new vaccinations runs out, the Biden administration is already preparing to ration vaccines for only the highest risk Americans this fall, when the CDC warns a new COVID wave could infect 100 million Americans. That warning is based on pure speculation, said Joel Zinberg in the New York Post, and it's designed to scare even more money out of Congress, even though tens of billions of dollars allocated for COVID remain unspent. With record inflation soaring, let's not throw more money at the virus. To surrender to the virus is unfathomable, said Eric Topol in The Guardian. Those who insist we must now live with COVID are ignoring the fact that the virus keeps getting better at evading existing vaccines and reinfecting the previously infected. Vaccine effectiveness against severe illness has declined from 95% against the original Wuhan virus to 80% even among those who've been boosted. Every infection carries the risk of long COVID, which can cause cognitive impairment, strokes, heart damage, persistent fatigue, and extreme shortness of breath. If we ever hope to make a definitive pandemic exit, we must revive Operation Warp Speed's urgency and double down on funding for boosters tailored to variants, easily administered nasal vaccines that block infection, and pan-coronavirus shots that defeat all variants. No, we don't have to live with COVID. And time for a few shorter notes. Nearly 319,000 of the more than 1 million COVID deaths in the U.S. could have been prevented if all eligible adults had gotten vaccinated, according to an analysis by researchers at Brown University and Microsoft AI Health. The states with the most preventable deaths were West Virginia, Wyoming, and Tennessee. Massachusetts had the fewest. In November, 27 states will choose a Secretary of State, the official who oversees elections. And in 17 of those states, at least one of the Republican candidates asserts that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. 14 of the Republican Secretary of State candidates have formed a coalition that pledges to eliminate mail balloting, require all voting to take place on Election Day and embark on an aggressive voter roll cleanup. A class action lawsuit brought by the survivors and families of victims of the Surfside condominium collapse in Florida last June has led to a settlement worth $997 million. The judge in the case said the figure was far in excess of what I'd anticipated. 98 people died in the collapse. Americans have spent more than $125 billion betting on sports in legal gambling companies in the 4 years since the Supreme Court opened the door for such outlets in all 50 states. On the poll watch, 52% of Americans agree that inflation is the most important issue facing the country, including 42% of Democrats and 65% of Republicans. 32% of Americans say their financial circumstances have worsened over the past year, while just 12% say their finances have improved. 78% of Americans blame supply chain issues for inflation, 51% blame government spending, and 32% blame wage increases for workers. And speaking of the economy, we will finish with a quote from economist Ezra Solomon, quoted in The Hill, who says, "The only function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.